Hey, Miyuki Okiranta here with Earshot. When we think about reducing carbon emissions, we generally think cars and coal-fired power stations. But have you ever thought about what's in your fridge? The way our food's produced is one of the biggest contributors to rising CO2 levels. If you could, would you choose food that you knew had been grown more sustainably?
At the moment, I wouldn't because I'm on unemployment benefits.
Yeah, I think I would, especially with the focus on environmental issues now.
Well, there's change afoot in our paddocks.
If we mimic Mother Nature, it can't not work. It's worked for millions of years. All we need to do is mimic that a lot closer.
Virginia and Reese Tapscott are young farmers from northwest New South Wales, and they've been wondering whether they should make the switch from conventional to conservation farming, or whether it'll send them broke. Let's follow their journey.
I reckon they'll be in car.
We just bought a small farm on the outskirts of Narrabri. This may not seem like a smart idea, considering we're currently in the grip of one of the worst droughts on record, but we figure it has to start raining at some point.
It's 50 hectares, it's 130 acres. I would consider to be at least 120 acres of arable land. Oh, it's beautiful black soil. Typically, our neighbours would want to plant a cotton crop into it. But, we'll see what happens.
How are you feeling about just having signed the mortgage agreement?
Oh, it's all right. It's another debt to worry about. Got to start somewhere.
Our best bet to start meeting our mortgage repayments is probably to grow a conventional cash crop when it eventually does rain. We're both from farming families. I grew up on a cotton farm. Reese's grandfather was a stock and station agent, and then his father got into cattle about 20 years ago. But a few common farming practices don't sit right with us. For one, we don't like using chemicals and the impacts they have on the environment and human health.
I don't like to think the amount of chemicals that goes under crops that we consume. It does bother me a bit. The chickpeas we have in the cupboard, from considering they think they come from the year when we had all those fungal blooms and they sprayed them every 2 weeks.
We have two little kids, Oscar's 3 and Elkie's 1, and we have another one on the way. So the whole idea of heavy-duty chemicals being sprayed where we live doesn't seem right. We'd also like to avoid clearing trees, and we really don't like bare soil. We've had a couple of severe dust storms this year, and our topsoil keeps ending up in my lounge room. We need to keep that soil on our farm to grow stuff. Last year, we stumbled across a new way of farming. It actually started with 2 dairy cows we bought from some hobby farmers who live over the hill from us in Bingra.
Got the same ideas, but we don't have much expertise, you know. So.
Yeah, that's right. But we're really good at making mistakes.
Well, I think everyone has to make mistakes.
Ralph and Joe Waters explained to us how they'd been farming in a more natural way. They'd transformed an old clay tennis court into a food forest by planting faba beans. And they used their chooks to naturally fertilise their garden beds.
If the chooks can do the work, it's I'd say a win-win, because we get chooks to eat, eggs to eat, and they do the weeding and feeding, and then we just come along, spread some straw and put in our plants, and it's infinitely better than what we have been doing.
They're almost completely self-sufficient, off the grid and chemical-free. As we were loading the cows onto the trailer, Ralph mentioned how they'd been able to stop worming their cows with a drench by feeding them a mix of minerals.
An animal arrived that was totally infested with parasites, and just diatomaceous earth has made all, you know, like a profound difference, a complete transformation.
To me, at the time, diatomaceous earth sounded like some kind of moon dust. We'd never heard anything like this. We thought they were a little bit wacky and that not drenching was kind of irresponsible. But they also handed us a book on natural farming, and now we want to find out more.
For food, like your eggs, or you'll be able to sell into them.
Our first stop is Colin Sice, a farmer near Golgong who's come up with an innovative way of growing crops. Normally, farmers plant into a pretty bare paddock, but Colin plants a crop directly into existing pasture. So he's not spraying or ploughing out the previous crop. To be honest, I'm a little bit starstruck. Colin is a big deal in the US, and his consultation work has triggered the restoration of millions of acres of grasslands. But something I find surprising is that his initial motivation to start pasture cropping was purely financial. In the late 70s, he basically went broke.
We had a major bushfire in 1979, which destroyed everything, the whole property, but we lost most of our sheep, 3,000 sheep out of 4,000, all the buildings, houses, fencing as well. So I had to develop a form of agriculture where I didn't spend any money at all, really, was no input agriculture, because couldn't afford anything. So I stopped fertilising, then stopped re-sowing pastures with clovers and ryegrasses and all those introduced species. The thing that I noticed, there was two things. Mostly the native grasses didn't mind if there was no fertiliser on them. They grew quite happily without fertiliser. So I thought, well, that was part of what I'd do. I'd encourage those native grasses to come back. In early 1990s, I started looking at a way of sowing crops that didn't kill the pastures. Where we're sowing crops, wheat crops, oat crops, all those winter crops, into grasses, the summer native grasses, that were dormant in the winter. So that worked extremely well the first year, and then I've been fine-tuning it ever since.
What followed on Colin's property over the next 20 years was an extraordinary transformation. Native grass varieties flourished, some which hadn't been seen in over half a century, and insect numbers increased sevenfold.
The farm ecosystem now has totally changed. Insect numbers increased, bird numbers increased, everything increased.
So he's got predatory insects actually controlling the pests for him, and he doesn't have to spray pesticides. And that's really cool.
A big player in this is the soil has improved dramatically, this whole soil ecosystem. It's a bit like the insect world. Crop damaging microbes or crop damaging fungi, things like that, get controlled by other microbes. Everything starts to fall into place once we get this functioning right.
The more organic matter you have in your soil, the more it becomes a sponge for carbon. So Colin's managed to triple the amount of carbon stored in his soil, and that helps to offset his carbon emissions. The vegans of the world aren't going to like this, but a crucial part of Colin's natural system is his livestock. Every natural ecosystem has animals in it. Why should our food production ecosystems be any different?
Use large mobs of sheep. Generally a mob of about 2,000 ewes is put onto a paddock which creates mulch, and add manure and urine to the paddock as well, which supplies nutrients to the crop that's going to be sown into it. If we put mulch on a paddock, it does a few things, or on a garden. It conserves moisture, it controls weeds, and it keeps the soil temperature at an even temperature.
Does that largely, in a way, resemble the way someone would treat their garden bed? And why have we strayed so far from that?
Mimicking natural systems doesn't generate a lot of income for multinational companies. In fact, it doesn't generate any income for multinational companies. Vested interests push back against many things that aren't going to increase their bottom line. So, yeah, this is a paddock, which is mostly a native area. This paddock was sown without a herbicide.
Colin still uses a very low rate of fertiliser and occasionally uses a herbicide. But the studies done on his property clearly show that he's achieved great environmental outcomes. Maybe I shouldn't be so hardline about not spraying chemicals. As we go for a drive down the paddock, the place looks amazing. Sheep happily grazing, there's grass everywhere in the middle of a drought. And there are a lot of trees. Many farmers lobby for the right to clear trees on their place. They argue that the demand for cheap food means they need to clear trees to farm more intensively to stay profitable. But Colin somehow managed to continue farming and plant over 20,000 trees, even in the middle of paddocks that he grows crops in.
These ones here, they've been just a single paddock tree we've planted as well, got scattered around. Because some of these trees are getting pretty old and struck by lightning like that, they won't last forever.
Colin's method of planting directly into pasture is extremely appealing to us because it cuts out a whole step in the process, which is cheaper and better for the environment. But we'd have to spend some money on additional fencing and watering systems and new planting equipment. And we'd have to adapt the system to different rainfall patterns and soil types on our own farm.
The thing that I noticed with Collins is his country is different to ours. They have predominant winter rainfall where they grow cereal crops, and that's not the case here. So the pasture cropping is going to be different.
Yeah. We're on heavy black soils in the middle of a floodplain, so we decide to visit a farm that's more similar, a chemical-free grazing property a little closer to home.
Hi. Good. Hi, yeah.
Derek Bloomfield and his wife Kiralee won the prestigious New South Wales Farmer of the Year Award in 2014. They're on 2,500 acres on the black soil Liverpool Plains. They've returned all their farming country to grazing and completely eliminated chemicals. In a good year, they run around 200 head of cows and calves.
We produce grass-fed beef and sell that direct to customers, to the public. And, yeah, it's all just produced here on the farm.
We head down the paddock to have a look, and it's probably one of my biggest light bulb moments. There's roly-poly weed everywhere. You might know it as tumbleweed. And Derek isn't spraying it or ploughing it out because he's actually using it.
A few years ago, we had this plant, roly-poly, grew just like it is out here now because we've had a hot, dry summer, so bare soil, roly-poly has flourished.
Yep. All my life I've seen roly-poly as this huge, annoying, prickly weed that competes with the grass, something to be removed. But Derek's made peace with the roly-poly.
And again, it's just a plant. You know, it's just another plant. It's inhospitable to animals now, as far as eating it goes, but they eat it while it's still soft and young. And that autumn, winter, we had this similar germination of ryegrass, and everywhere that there was a roly-poly plant, in underneath it, the ryegrass was thick and green and ended up growing up through the roly-poly.
Yep.
And everywhere out in the spaces where the roly-poly wasn't, the ryegrass was just, you know, not half the plant. And it just really showed us the importance of plants helping plants.
This is huge. What if we saw weeds as a good thing? We have so much roly-poly on our land. Maybe we could use it to restore the health of our soil.
And it's this perfect little symbiotic, you know, relationship that we can embrace and work with, or we can come in and cultivate, we can come in and use herbicides, you know, disrupt that system and that cycle.
And then have to do more because you've intervened in the beginning.
Yeah, you're in a vortex then,
yep.
Which has been really effective for some decades, you know, but is completely unsustainable, mm-hmm. completely unsustainable.
He thinks it's unsustainable for a few reasons. Weeds are becoming resistant to herbicides, and continually stripping out the nutrients and then trying to replace them by adding nitrogen is a band-aid solution to the underlying problem of soil degradation.
I don't know. I mean, if something's brought people a lot of cash wealth, then I can see that why would they want to change that? You know, most people probably think, well, yeah, I can keep, the system will be the same in 10 years. Well, what about 50? Yeah, it probably will. Why wouldn't it? You know, what about 100? You know, it's completely unsustainable.
How do you deal with people who still would think that you're mad, like not spraying out the weeds or not trying to control them? Do you just have to shrug your shoulders and say, well, we're on this path and you're on that? Or
yeah, and look, I just generally don't have the conversation because no one says it to me.
Yeah.
You know, I guess there may be people saying it, but I don't hear it, so it doesn't matter.
We need to unpack this. I think the social pressures around farming a certain way are definitely there. I've heard what people say about one of the only organic farmers in our region. They call him the hippie on the hill. To put it bluntly, people think he's lost the plot, even though he seems to be doing well. It doesn't seem to worry Derek as much now, but in the beginning it did bother him.
Those first couple of years, that paddock fronts the road, and it was a disgrace, you know. Fleabane, roly-poly, you name it. Castor oil plant, yeah, Naguras, just all of the love children of chemical cropping, yep. You know, all of the cast-offs. Yeah, I was embarrassed by it. I found that tough. Kiralee was a lot more positive, you know, completely positive, and thought it was great.
Yeah,
and
growing.
Yeah, exactly. And anyway, we just kept putting animals in, and it became a grassland. And within 4 years, it was a fully populated Queensland bluegrass paddock just from grazing it. We now harvest that seed off that paddock to sell for grass seed, and you know, things can just transition. So instead of fighting the processes of nature, you know, we just try and observe it, look at it, how can we work with it.
This makes so much sense to me, but it's really hard to find out about this kind of farming. It's like an underground network, and they speak a new kind of language. Even the way Derek speaks about his trees is striking. He's always watching them, and he's sensitive to what's going on with them. I haven't really heard other blokes talk like this about their land.
I've just put about 26 or 8 mesh rings around Little Mile and Cooper trees out here on the plain that have propagated themselves and succeeded, which is great because, well, it's just more diversity, shelter for animals. It's nature batting last.
When we hop back in the ute, Derek explains how the natural ecosystems are all falling into place. It's the curious case of a nasty, nasty weed called tiger pear.
If there's a devil, that's its love child, you know. And I didn't know how I was going to deal with it and still maintain that chemical-free status. I went up to that same site a month or two ago and I noticed the tiger pear was either dead or dying from cochineal, which is a little parasitic insect that gets in and just dries out the pear. And it was just fully infesting a lot of plants. So I went around with big barbecue tongs and a garbage bin collecting little infected segments of tiger pear and spreading it to other areas where it isn't as prolific. And that's just solving it for me, you know, without having to spray anything, without having to pull any more out. Nature taking things into its own hands a bit.
Yeah.
When we get back home, I check Derek's roly-poly theory, and sure enough, the best grass is growing in the shelter of the roly-poly. Plants helping plants.
Yeah, well, I liked what Derek and Kiralee are doing. That's the only farm we've been to that's going to be
very similar
to what we're doing.
But one thing I'm still confused about is, if we do go down the regenerative farming path, how would the finances stack up for us? So we asked our agronomist, Drew Penberthy, how much money we could make if we straight up farmed the place using chemicals.
My advice for the biggest cash crop you could do in the quickest amount of time would be probably put a cereal, like a wheat or a barley, into that country. For a couple of reasons, you get really good ground cover, which will then start your regenerative process and get more moisture into the soil and all that sort of stuff. But also you're probably going to have the quickest return on that investment.
But Drew says we'd need to apply chemicals and minerals.
Can we run the numbers on how much you could make from that, given the inputs and given the area? It's only a small area.
Yeah. Oh, well, this year might be a bit hard unless it starts raining. But yes. And this is the risk with all this sort of stuff. High input, higher risk.
Yeah.
So that's one of the key issues you've got with a high cash crop. If it goes wrong, you're in trouble. But you could be talking up to, once you've taken your costs out, $600-$700 a hectare.
That's about a $20,000 profit in our first year. And there is no way we'll make that using regenerative practices. And there's the problem. The restoration of agricultural land relies on farmers like us choosing long-term solutions that may not make them the most money initially. we'd likely have to cop the initial losses until the long-term productivity improvements started appearing. Drew says economies of scale are going to make it difficult for agriculture to change.
Farmers have got bigger, they've expanded. Cost of farming now is a lot higher than it ever used to be. So if you miss a season, once upon a time you missed a season, well, you know, it'll be right next year. Well, if you miss one now, it really hits the bottom line. And so that's why everyone's so critical trying to make a profit every year, I suppose, but still trying to make it sustainable over the long term. It's a pretty hard thing to try and get right.
I should mention here that Drew's also a highly respected broadacre farmer around here. He uses most of the conventional chemicals used to grow a crop, but here's the thing. He's also implementing many of the regenerative practices we've been talking about. And Drew acknowledges that he has a role to play in dealing with our climate crisis.
The weather patterns are definitely more erratic than they were 30 years ago. Our summer storms are more intense, longer between the events, but more intense when they turn up. I've got no doubt about that. Why? I have no idea. We're certainly a big player in it, but I've got to adapt my farming system to it. I mean, we're always trying to reduce. We don't farm like we used to, so we're not using the chemicals we used to with our farming. You know, we've gone to GM cotton, for example, we've reduced herbicide use by 90%. You know, we're not farming as much anymore, so we're not burning the diesel we used to do. So we're sort of going down the track, and we're always trying to get more carbon in our soils because that's how our system revolves around it. We're stopping the erosion as much as we possibly can by keeping ground cover. We're reducing our fertiliser input so we're not overdoing it. I don't know what the answer to that one is. We're just trying to do what we can with what we're given as best we can and try and stay here.
I'd like to think most farmers are on the same page as Drew, but I'd say he's probably more forward-thinking than most.
They've been in that system for a long time, a lot of them. The system works, there's no doubt about that. Hopefully it works for a long, long time, as long as we keep adapting and doing things right. But that's what they're used to it, they're set up for it, and that's what they do. And why change something that's not broken?
On the way out, we have a look at one of the crops Drew planted for ground cover.
Yeah.
Obviously here we're in a bit of a bare patch where we never got the millet up. I don't like the look of that.
Yeah.
It just upsets me, but I can't do anything about it, unfortunately, at the moment. So.
Yeah.
When he's talking about soil health, he's sounding exactly like the regenerative farmers we visited. If Colin and Derek are right, and there are natural systems that can do the farming work for us and replace chemical use in the long term, it seems absolutely pointless to spend all our time and money fighting against nature. It seems like a broken system. There are other things we want to do with our time, like Ralph and Joe Waters from Bingra.
The most precious commodity there is actually time. If you don't have time to enjoy your wife and you don't have time to enjoy your family, you don't really have a life. You might think you do, but you're not really enjoying life itself. And so what we do is geared around making for us a richness of life. That's the way we look at what we do. Yeah, we enjoy a much higher standard of living, and it's not measured in dollars.
Now we're so relaxed. We've got this lovely little old country farmhouse and it suits us down to the ground, and it's a bit messy, and it's, you know, there's a bit of paint peeling and things aren't pristine, and I don't care. It doesn't make any difference. We have this kitchen table. We have so many friends around this table, and we have the freedom to feed them from our farm, to spend the time with them, and that's a treasure. That's a treasure that a lot of people, I think, miss.
After coming back to where our journey began in Bingra, Rhys and I think we definitely have a plan. There is a better way to live, and we have to try it. The first step is to get the cattle off our place. When it starts raining again, we'll plant crops to feed our cattle. As the cattle mulch and fertilise the soil, we're confident native grasses will reappear. Down the track, this should mean we don't rely as much on planting crops for fodder, and instead we might harvest native grass seed that grows naturally. We'll move our cattle around the property in a way that mimics how herd animals move on grasslands, leaving an area to rest for many months, allowing the soil ecosystem to recover.
For me,
A regenerative practice would be letting nature run nature and trying to work with nature to get an outcome that is better than what we started with. I just sort of think that if a plant can't grow naturally in the soil and we have to add some sort of synthetic substance for it to grow, then I think there's a bit of a bigger issue in the soil.
And we've already planted around 100 trees, but I'm aiming for a lot more. The place is too quiet. We need the birds to come back. Agriculture is said to be the single biggest contributor to the destruction of the environment and rising CO2 emissions. So it's also the single most powerful thing we can change to mitigate climate change. We want to be part of that. We want our kids to see a future that's full of positive change, driven by farmers. But one thing I still want to know is, will consumers support us?
Absolutely, absolutely we would. That's important, I think, to support sustainability, and, you know, it also helps with our health and future well-being.
So if I knew that, you know, I could make a conscious choice of choosing products that were better for the environment, I would. Well, global warming is a big issue and we're just trying to reduce our footprint and try to preserve the environment, like for the children and for our next generation.
At the moment I wouldn't, because I'm on unemployment benefits, but when I'm working generally I try and, like, for example, buy free range eggs instead of caged eggs, so forth, stuff like that, more health orientated.
Yeah, I think I would, especially with the focus on environmental issues now. People are becoming more aware, so I think I'd probably pay more for it now rather than a couple of years ago. Yeah.
Yes, I would. I feel like it just feels good. You see a lot of, like, the impact that's happening, especially now. It just, like, feels good morally to do it, because, you know, it's like doing something better for the environment.
Well, that's reassuring. People are making the connection between cheap food and global warming. But at the moment, there isn't really a clear choice on our supermarket shelves. As far as I know, you can't buy carbon-neutral pasta or lamb produced with zero land clearing, even though these products do exist. So I think it's up to us to give people that choice. I think the future of the planet depends on it.
Virginia Tapps got there, and she produced this episode of Earshot. The sound engineer was Bella Troppiano, and the supervising producer was Claudia Taranto. And Virginia and Reese, the best of luck with your transition to a regenerative practice. Let us know when you'll be hitting the farmers' markets. I'm Miyuki Okiranta. You've been listening to Earshot.